Today on The Takeaway for February 25th, in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein verdict, we start the discussion with you.
I think the verdict will not change the Me Too movement. I believe the case will give future victims courage to come forward and possibly even allow victims to speak up sooner.
I felt the verdict was reassuring in this climate of misinformation and fake news that the system is working toward something that's equitable and fair for people.
I hope this absolutely changes how these cases are tried. Rape is rape. No more being powerful and getting away with breaking the law.
A historic moment in the Me Too movement. We're talking about it. Plus, President Trump's first visit to India and what that means for both countries, and a whole lot more. Let's get to it. I'm Arun Vanagopal with you, and this is The Takeaway.
It's a new day because Harvey Weinstein has finally been held accountable for crimes he committed. The women who came forward courageously and at great risk made that happen.
After weeks of highly public and emotional testimony, the trial of Harvey Weinstein came to an end.
Rape is rape, whether it's committed by a stranger in a dark alley or by an intimate partner in a working relationship. It's rape, whether it's committed by an indigent person or a man of immense power, prestige, and privilege. Rape is rape, whether the survivor reports within an hour, within a year, or perhaps never.
That was Manhattan DA Cy Vance speaking at a press conference yesterday after the disgraced Hollywood mogul was found guilty of third-degree rape and first-degree criminal sexual assault. Weinstein could now face up to 29 years in prison.
Harvey Weinstein will now have to finally face the serious consequences of his criminal behavior at his sentencing here in New York on March 11th.
Gloria Allred there, who represented several of the victims. And though he was found guilty on two charges, Weinstein was acquitted of three other ones, including the most serious charge, predator sexual assault. Six women took the witness stand during his trial: Jessica Mann, Mimi Haley, Annabella Sciorra, Dawn Dunning, Tara Lee Wolf, Lauren Young. Their allegations represent just a fraction of Weinstein's alleged abusive behavior. At least 100 other women have spoken publicly about being sexually assaulted and harassed by him. In 2015, Manhattan DA Vance, who you just heard, declined to arrest and prosecute Weinstein for a misdemeanor sex crime. This was despite an NYPD sting operation that caught Weinstein on tape admitting to groping Ambra Batilana Gutierrez, who filed a police report against him. Weinstein's case has become synonymous with the Me Too era. Yesterday's verdict is a historic moment for the women at the center of this trial and survivors everywhere. Let's talk about it. We turn to Irene Carmon, senior correspondent at New York Magazine, and Shayna Jacobs, who covers New York federal courts for The Washington Post. Thanks to you both for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Irene, your story was headlined, "The Weinstein Verdict is Radical." What makes this radical?
Harvey Weinstein has been synonymous with Me Too. He's been kind of the monster of what we've learned about sexual assault and harassment. But it's one thing to have more than 100 women courageously speak out about someone. It's quite another to get a criminal conviction based on the cases of two women that were quite complex in their facts. For the jury to understand that an individual can be sexually assaulted or raped by somebody like Harvey Weinstein on one day and send them an affectionate note or even have consensual sex with them afterwards is something that's relatively new for people to understand. We might think about it as being closer to domestic violence, but this was a different kind of relationship. It was women who were seeking career advancement through Harvey Weinstein, who exerted an enormous amount of power. Now, it wasn't the entire system that was on trial. It wasn't all of the enablers of Harvey Weinstein. It wasn't his economic power that was on trial. It was, did he assault these two women? And so for the jury to say beyond a reasonable doubt that he did, I think takes us in a different direction than where we've been before with respect to criminal law.
Shanna, were you surprised by this verdict?
I don't know that I was surprised. I agree that this is the case that the Manhattan DA's office brought against Weinstein now is the kind of case that would have been considered untouchable prior to October 2017 when the Me Too movement essentially began. The stories that Mimi Halei and Jessica Mann told were extremely complicated, you know, to the point where there was a big question of whether the jury would understand what they were saying, that they were assaulted and then continued to maintain contact with Weinstein for years. And, you know, they admitted that they wanted him in their lives because they thought he could be beneficial. They were both sort of like struggling in their careers. They were trying to establish themselves in one way or another. Mimi was trying to get, at some point, was trying to get him to adopt TV scripts that she had written. And Jessica Mann was trying to become an actress. And neither of them really became successful in what they were seeking at the time. But it didn't stop them from maintaining contact with Weinstein. So the jury had a very serious question in front of them, and that was, is it possible that they were victims of sexual assault, even though email records and other evidence and even their own testimony contradicts the commonly held thought of how a sexual assault victim behaves?
Irene, Weinstein was found guilty of these two charges, but found not guilty of the other three. Can you remind us of what those were?
Sure. Two of those charges were predatory sexual assault related, which would have required accepting the testimony of Annabella Sciorra, who said that Harvey Weinstein raped her in either late 1993 or early 1994. And then there was also a charge related to Jessica Mann, which was first degree rape, which they opted to go with third degree rape in her case. And these would have, the predatory sexual assault cases were the most serious out of all the felonies with which he was charged. Ultimately, we don't know why it was that they decided not to convict on Annabella Sciorra's testimony. I find it really interesting as somebody who I've reported on sexual assault and harassment for a very long time. I've spoken to countless victims. And we have this sort of notion of the perfect victim that this case challenged in many ways. But I have to say that many people assume that Annabella Sciorra's account aligned most closely with what people assume a perfect victim is. She was in her apartment. She says that Harvey Weinstein broke down the door, held her down, and raped her. That said, the challenge that this case, all of the cases, but especially Annabella Sciorra's account had, is that a lot of time had passed. And in her case in particular was by far the oldest. And so while we do not know why it was that first on Friday the jury deadlocked in her case and subsequently decided not to convict with respect to her account, we do know that it was almost 27 years. Yeah. And she did not know the exact date. There wasn't other evidence. She did tell her friend Rosie Perez, who did testify. But that said, given that we heard from so many different women in this trial, it's impossible to separate that out from the jury's decision on if the question was that they were weighing Harvey Weinstein's credibility or his defense's credibility against these women. It was the two women on whose cases they convicted him, but it was also this cascade of voices saying that Harvey Weinstein was someone who had a pattern of predation, taking advantage of vulnerable women and, as prosecutors said, treating them like ants to be crushed.
What are we hearing from Weinstein and his team? You were outside the courthouse yesterday, correct?
I was, yes.
Tell me more about what are they saying right now?
Their biggest thing right now is that they don't believe Weinstein had a fair trial at all. They're going to fight vigorously to get his conviction appealed, which is not necessarily an easy thing. But they're going to focus on the, I'm not sure if it's unprecedented media attention to this case. We have the, obviously other huge trials in history, like O.J. Simpson, comes to mind. But this case began with, on day one, the Los Angeles DA's office dropping a new indictment. And, you know, every newspaper in the world was writing about it. I mean, they really don't believe that he got a fair trial at all. There were rulings they disagreed with from start to finish. Evidence came in, and they are, you know, I'm sure they're going to focus very heavily on the fact that three women who were not officially part of the charges were allowed to come in and testify against him. They're going to say that the DA's office was just piling it on, that they created this image of him as, you know, a villain, as a monster, as someone who habitually assaulted women. I think they're just going to be heavily focusing on the fact that, in their view, didn't have a fair trial at all.
Irene, Me Too has been playing out in the press for a few years now, but this one, like the Cosby case, actually had its day in court. How critical are convictions like this?
You know, it's complicated because every lever of power that Harvey Weinstein had, he exercised to avoid this day. He did so much to stay outside of a courtroom. He hired ex-Mossad spies. He intimidated journalists. He intimidated women. He paid millions of dollars in settlements, all so that he would not see the inside of a courtroom. And for a long time, it worked. We heard the beautiful words of Cy Vance, but we also know that for years, Cy Vance has declined to prosecute very powerful men. Jeffrey Epstein was in New York's jurisdiction. There was famously the case brought by a hotel housekeeper, the complaint brought by a hotel housekeeper against Dominique Strauss-Kahn, in which Cy Vance's office dropped it. Robert Haddon, the gynecologist, also now they recently reopened an investigation after many more women came forward. And so I think we have to see this in the context of the fact that an unequal justice system comes down on people who cannot fight it as Harvey Weinstein fought it. So if a powerful person like Harvey Weinstein is seeing accountability in court, it may just be a drop in the bucket. It may be, you know, most people who are sexually assaulted, they're not famous actresses. They aren't accusing somebody who they make jokes about him at the Oscars. And a criminal conviction may not be what they want. Many survivors have said that they find even just the process of what these women went through, sitting on the stand, being cross-examined for hours, re-traumatizing. That said, this is one lever in a broader system that has not been responsive to complaints from victims who did want to go through the criminal justice system and did want to see their alleged predators go to prison. And so I do think it's huge that the jury accepted the complex facts of this case. It's different from what we've seen before. But it's just one part of a bigger system that Harvey Weinstein used to his advantage to get away with it and to silence women for years.
Shannon, were there any particular moments from reporting on this that stood out to you? Pivotal moments, perhaps?
The testimony in general was just so a thing to witness. These women were clearly forever affected by their interactions with Weinstein. And it was, I mean, they came forward in front of dozens of people in the courtroom and everyone in the world reporting on what they were saying. So it was a very courageous thing for them to do this. It was no light thing. It was no easy thing. Their names forever are going to be associated with this case. So it was a momentous thing to witness. The trial was just, we were watching history play out in front of us. And, you know, I think it was a very powerful thing.
Shana Jacobs covers New York federal courts for The Washington Post. And Irene Carmon is a senior correspondent at New York Magazine. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanigopal. That's the sound of the 21-gun salute greeting President Trump as he arrived in India this week. And his trip has been a study in stark contrasts. The country is being rocked by violent protests as the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi pushes forward a new citizenship law that discriminates against Muslims. The violence against Muslims has been escalating. Black smoke clouds cover the New Delhi skies as government forces and Hindu mobs descend upon Muslim demonstrators. Videos show officials beating injured protesters and forcing them to sing patriotic songs. The top trending hashtag in India right now is Delhi Burning. And it is into this particular moment that President Trump made his visit, with all the stagecraft it entails. The two countries signed a $3 billion defense deal that would provide India with attack helicopters and other U.S. military equipment.
I know Prime Minister Modi will agree that this has been a very productive visit for both of our countries.
So helping to break this all down, we're joined by Barkha Dutt, a columnist with The Washington Post, and she joins us now from Delhi. Barkha, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Arun.
It feels like an incredible disconnect between this reception being accorded to President Trump and what is actually happening all around him right there in Delhi. Is that how you're seeing things?
Well, Arun, I think it's literally surreal to see this grand state banquet, taking place for President Trump, while India's capital is effectively aflame. Delhi is burning. 10 people have died at last count. This includes a policeman, a head constable, and 9 civilians. All evening, I have been getting distress SOS messages from residents who are talking about targeted violence, mobs entering their homes. Places of worship have been attacked. There's a distinct communal dimension to the violence that is taking place. And yes, as important as high-profile visit as President Trump's is, for most Indians, there's a complete dissonance in the grandeur and the optics and the spectacle of this visit and what's actually going down in our capital city.
And would you say that the Indian media is playing this up alongside each other, or has the visit by the president been overshadowed?
Well, I think depending on which network you watch and which newspaper you read, you'll see different treatments. I think there are organizations that are softer on the government and have stuck to a kind of officialdom driven coverage. But, you know, by the end of the day, the story of what was happening in Delhi, the Delhi violence, was just too big to ignore for anybody. And even at that press conference that President Trump addressed, you had one of the accompanying American journalists ask him about it in the larger context of the citizenship legislation, just to give perspective to people who are listening. Delhi has seen many protests against a contentious new anti-Muslim, in my opinion, citizenship legislation that the government just passed. And what we've seen in the last few days have been counter-protests, people and groups that support this legislation. And what we saw today, or in the last 48 hours, have been clashes between these two groups, while unfortunately the police has just stood by and enabled this violence that has led to 10 fatalities.
That's right. There are videos of police officers beating people, Muslims, forcing them to sing patriotic songs like Vande Mataram. Is there any way to know if the Modi government is behind this or simply looking the other way?
No, I wouldn't implicate the Modi government in this. I certainly would implicate the Delhi police, and I would implicate a bunch of politicians, including a BJP politician, Kapil Mishra, who a couple of days ago was basically saying that all of these people who've been protesting against the citizenship legislation must clear out of the public spaces that they've been occupying. And he pretty much said that if the people did not leave, then they would have to face the consequences. In other words, I saw his statement as an incitement to violence. I actually don't think what's happening suits the Modi government at all. Why would the Modi government want the Delhi violence to be the international headline on a day when I think Prime Minister Modi would have very much hoped for the Trump visit to dominate the global headlines and certainly the American media, especially because, Arun, I don't think I've ever seen President Trump this controlled, almost like a muted version of himself. He didn't make a gaffe, as the Indian side was worried about. He didn't say anything particularly to embarrass them. He may not have committed to much in terms of specifics, but, you know, it was a high moment for the Modi government. And I would imagine that the Prime Minister is rather enraged by the fact that the Delhi violence has completely cast a long shadow over this Trump visit and almost knocked it out from its position as a lead story.
From the Indian government's perspective, is Trump's silence on this issue a diplomatic victory?
I think yes, I would say that, because, you know, Trump prefaced his press conference by saying he did not want to make anything contentious because that would take away from his visit. And like I said, I mean, he was kind of surprisingly, well-behaved, if I may use that phrase. I mean, he didn't do any equivalent of tweeting in all caps. And when he was specifically asked about the citizenship legislation, he said, I leave that to India. That's for India to settle. But he did confirm that the issue of religious freedom was discussed, and he said it was discussed at length. And the Prime Minister explained to him that there are 200 million Muslims in India, and that religious freedom is very important to the Modi government. Now, all of this is deeply ironic, because this is all coming against the backdrop of what's happening in Delhi, which, you know, where the violence has started as, yes, as clashes between two sets of groups, and both sides have at least based on my eyewitness reports, both sides have been guilty of violence. But by the end of the day, we're getting extremely distressing reports of places of worship a mosque. I've seen a video that I couldn't actually release because I thought it would inflame the situation more, but places of worship, targeted, and communally targeted violence. And so, yes, there has been violence on both sides. We also spoke to the father of a young Hindu man who has been shot and killed. So both groups have committed violence. Both groups have pelted stones. But the real story is the willful apathy and the incompetence of the police. And all of this is what the world has watched. I mean, Delhi was on the global stage today because President Trump was here. And instead, the global story is this horrific riot that is taking place in our capital city, and those numbers, that the 10 dead could rise because many are still critically injured in hospital.
Barkha Dutt, the columnist with The Washington Post. Barkha, thanks so much for joining us from Delhi.
Thank you.
They shoot journalists on sight in the capital. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Karen.
Nearly 1 million women alive today report being shot or shot at by an intimate partner.
He did say, no one will believe you. And I understood the system at that time and that no one would believe me.
Guns escalate the danger in any domestic violence situation.
You're back with The Takeaway. Some voices there from our series this week on the link between domestic violence and guns. Today we hear from a survivor of gun violence at the hands of her husband. Her name is Lisette Johnson.
I lived in quite a nice neighborhood in the outskirts of Richmond, Virginia. My kids went to preschool, elementary school, middle school with the same kids, Cub Scouts, ballet, Saturday morning soccer. We were, an average American family, and what others weren't aware of is what was going on within our household. My husband was verbally abusive and financially abusive.
There was physical abuse, too.
Pushing, shoving, hair pulling.
But Lisette says it was less prevalent than other forms of abuse.
We had one major physical abuse 8 years, 9 years prior to this. It was mostly emotional and verbal abuse. And he had threatened, right after our second child, my son, was born. I had said, I'm not going to be treated like this. I'm not going to be demeaned, berated. And he literally calmly looked at me and said, if you try and mess with my life, I'll put a bullet through your head.
Lisette told me she thought it was a strange overreaction at the time, but not foreshadowing. And as things got bad, Lisette said she was afraid to go to the police. She thought she would never be believed because her husband was well-respected.
He played Little League with the same friends he had in his adult life. He was a sales manager at an oil company. He was very well thought of in the community. No one would have believed it. And as well, I did not feel like the police would believe me. And he did say, no one will believe you. And I understood the system at that time and that no one would believe me. So I tried to manage things. I tried to do the best I could with my children. I'd owned several businesses, so I was very active in those businesses and growing those businesses. As I said, the children were involved in lots of extracurricular activities, and I was socially engaged. I was a big networker. So I tried to live my life, if you will, but it became so overbearing, and I saw that it was so really detrimental to the children that I wanted to make some changes, and that included having them be around him on a more limited basis and leaving the marriage.
And how did he react when you told him you were leaving? I take it that at one point he raised the fact that you were in therapy.
His first reaction to my request to separate was, you'll never see your children again. And I sort of taken aback, and I said, what do you mean? And he said, you know, to him, a therapist was a psychiatric record. You know, you've got a psychiatric record. I'll make sure you never see them again. I'll go for full custody.
Just to get a sense of your home, you and your husband owned guns, correct?
I did not own guns. I've never felt a need to own guns. My husband was a hunter. He also worked in a sketchy area of town, so he felt the need to have a handgun in his glove box just in case something happened. So guns were readily available and accessible in our household.
Bring us to the night a little over 8 years ago when, I guess, everything changed. What happened that night?
Things had been ramping up. When I told him that I wanted to separate, he refused to leave the house. He said, you need to leave the house. I'm not going to abandon my marital property. You cannot take the kids. You go find someplace. And of course, my goal was to keep the children stable, to not have anything negatively affect them more than simply, you know, a pending divorce, and, you know, keep them in their school system. So I'd hoped that he would leave the house. And then he indeed said he would leave. He said, I'm going to stay with a friend. I'm going to sail a boat down the coast. I'm going to get my own place. And as each week went by, he would not leave. And so I did make the decision finally that I would have to be the one leaving, and I would have to leave the children with him until I could figure out how to go back and get them. And so once I made that decision, he clearly understood he was definitely losing control of the situation. So his behavior escalated. He started reading my emails, intercepting my mail, going on my phone, appearing places that I never told him where I was going to be. And his behavior was almost frantic. He was meeting with friends and saying, I can't live without her. He was reading my emails, intercepting my mail, going on my phone, appearing places that I never told him where I was going to be. And his behavior was almost frantic. He was meeting with friends and saying, I can't live without her. He was contacting my therapist and saying, you need to check out, you know, these psychiatric conditions I think she's suffering from. He was extraordinarily jealous. Things were really getting out of control very quickly, and I was trying very quickly to get out of the house. And my son's birthday, his 10th birthday, was coming up. We planned a party for he and about eight of his little fourth grade friends. And we were going to go to the movies, go see Toy Story, and then everyone would come back to the house for a cookout. At that time, when we got back, my husband was extremely calm, very calm, eerily so. And I didn't quite know what was up, but I knew something was up. And I couldn't have predicted what he had in his mind. The next morning, he said, I'm going to go to my sister's house. I was going to church, and I said, hey, can you just stay here with the kids until they wake up? My daughter was 12. Yeah, I said, you know, I just don't like to leave them sleeping. They'll be fine for an hour till I get home from church. When I arrived home from church, he had asked me, hey, you know, come lay down with me on the guest room bed. And I said, look, we're getting divorced. And he followed me into the guest room. And he said, you know, I want to know how you plan on living when you leave here, meaning financially. I said, I don't know, but I have enormous faith and I'll figure it out. And I went and sat in a chair in the corner, and he walked back in and he stood at the foot of the bed about 4 feet from me. And he had his hand under a hand towel. It looked like when a kid makes a play gun with their, you know, thumb and index finger. But I immediately knew. I mean, everything just sort of came together. And as I sat in the chair, he pulled the towel off and raised the gun. He said, I love you too much to live without you. And he was aiming at my head, but I stood up immediately. And I ran past him and away from him while he was shooting me. I was screaming to my children, get out of the house, get out of the house, call 911. My daughter, I could hear her saying, Mommy, Mommy, what's going on? And I had to tell her, Daddy shot me. You've got to get out of the house. And I was running out of the house. And I heard a final shot, and I did not know who he had shot. And I knew if I turned around to find out that I wouldn't be able to continue. So I kept running away from the house. And he had shot himself, but I did not know that. Someone heard the gunshots and called 911. So the police did come. They did have to stage the area for EMTs before I could be treated. I was in and out of consciousness. I didn't know where my kids were. And pretty much kept asking, where are my kids? Where are my kids? Where are my kids? They told me, but I couldn't retain consciousness enough to grasp onto what they were saying.
How many times had you been shot and where?
I didn't even know, and the surgeons didn't even know, but four. One in my back. I have a bullet still in my liver. I have a bullet in my right breast. Near the chest wall, and then one exited through my diaphragm. So both my lungs were blown out. My diaphragm was blown out. The bullet that is in my liver is pretty close to my heart. By the time I got to the hospital, they prepared me very quickly for surgery, and my blood pressure was extremely low, and my heart rate was very high. So you know, when I met with the surgeon who performed the surgery afterwards, her words were, we thought we'd lost you. And I couldn't let that happen because I know those two children, I knew those two children were waiting for you. And she knew at that time, which I didn't know, that my husband had then since died.
So it's somewhat miraculous that you survived.
It's very miraculous. And, you know, that saying, to whom much is given, much as required. So that's why I do this.
And by this, you mean?
Being an advocate for women, for survivors of intimate partner violence, but also doing the legislative work that I've done, because that's where it's got to start. It's got to start in better laws. It's got to start with having, my belief is, having restrictions on who can own guns and at what time it is dangerous for them to own guns. My husband was certainly a legal gun owner. Up until that point, there was no reason to believe something like this would happen. I knew internally, but no one externally knew. I didn't have any recourse to say, I'm concerned, he's made some threats, I'd like to get these guns out of the house. I could have petitioned law enforcement and said, look, you know, he's stalking me. He's made these threats. We have this history of abuse. These are all patterns that lead up to a potential lethal incident. Can you come get his guns? But that protective order at the time would not have required him to surrender guns. So I have this protective order, which is pretty much banging on the hornet's nest. Now he's really mad. Now he's really has nothing to lose. And I think for him, he felt like he was losing everything. So this was, he had nothing more to lose.
Lisette Johnson is a domestic violence survivor, consultant, speaker, and author of Nights That Felt Like Love. Thanks for being here, Lisette.
Thank you for having me.
Lisette told me today that she's an advocate for extreme risk protection orders, known often as red flag laws. She says that could have saved her life a decade ago. As we talk about domestic violence this week on the show, we want to remind you that if you or someone you know is affected by intimate partner violence and needs help, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE for support in English and Spanish. That's 1-800-799-7233. More in our series on guns and domestic violence tomorrow. On February 25th, 1960, in Montgomery, Alabama, a group of 35 black men and women took part in the first sit-in against segregation in the state. Comprised mostly of students from Alabama State College, the demonstrators asked to be served at a whites-only snack bar in the Montgomery County Courthouse. When police officers came to respond to the sit-in and forced the group out, the students stayed put for about an hour. And while they eventually left the building without getting arrested, the protest did not sit well with Alabama's segregationist governor, John Patterson. Patterson reached out to the school's president and pressured him to punish the student demonstrators. Nine of them were expelled, and the other participating students were also penalized. It took the state of Alabama until 2018 to apologize and clear those punishments from the former students' records. Joining me now to discuss the legacy of the sit-in, 60 years later, is St. John Dixon. St. John took part in the sit-in and was expelled by the university. St. John, thank you so much for coming on The Takeaway.
Okay.
So what do you remember about the days and weeks leading up to the sit-in, and how did you ultimately decide that this Montgomery State Courthouse was the best place to demonstrate?
Well, leading up to the sit-in, we decided that we should do something to deal with the inequities and the unjust treatments that we were getting. And we felt that it was our turn to actually take part, because we was tired of being dehumanized by the system and so forth. So a number of students decided they would get together. And the reason we chose the courthouse, we wanted to do it in a state-supported building rather than to do it with the different chain store restaurants and so forth. And leading up to the demonstration, it was over 150 people who decided that they would do this from the college. And when closer it got to the time to demonstrate, we only had about 30, 35 people who actually participated at the time. As we got to the courthouse, we were told that we would not be served and so forth. And there were a number of times the N-word was used. But we say that we're going to stay here until we're served. And we were taking a chance on being arrested or being beaten. And we felt that one of the reasons that we felt that we should do this, because the governor at that time, John Patterson, had made a statement that the students from Alabama State were not educated enough to actually do something like that, that we were not smart enough to do this. And they had a couple of other demonstrations in other cities, and we felt that it was our time to actually make a statement and let them know that we were not afraid, and that we were ready to actually make a statement to the world that, hey, this is unjust, and we're going to do what we got to do. And like I said, we sit down so others could stand. So it was a very trying experience. And we were threatened as we got to the courthouse that if we didn't leave, that we would be arrested or whatever. We said, well, we're going to stay until that happened. And one of the policemen came up to me and asked me what was my name. And I said, well, unless I'm arrested, I'd rather remain anonymous. And that was not something that a black should say to a policeman here at Montgomery. And this is one of the things that really happened. And as a result of what we did, I was considered a leader, because I had attended all of the demonstrations and the meetings and so forth that they had. But I felt that I was not really a leader at that time. I was just a participant. But I was one of the nine that was expelled. And I was expelled, and they call it my case, Dixon versus the State of Alabama Board of Education. But there were nine of us, and the reason they named it after my case is that I was the only litigant to actually testify at the trial, which we found out later that some time later I found out that we won the case, and it went all the way to the Fifth Circuit, and that's how we won, and they were willing to actually rescind that order in terms of what happened. And 50 years later, they called us back and had us walk across the stage and gave us our degree.
So, sir, were you nervous? I mean, clearly your willingness to speak out against a police officer to testify and all that suggests that you weren't. But inside, how'd you feel?
Well, you know, that was a bit of nerve there, but I felt that what I was doing was greater than the nerves that I was dealing with at the time. And because of things that had happened in my life and how my father was discriminated against and talked to by whites in my little hometown, I said, well, hey, you know, we got to do something. And I'm willing to take a chance. And I know, being a close friend of the late Dr. Martin Luther King, we were taught to be nonviolent. So therefore, we didn't fight back or whatever. We just took whatever came. And that was one of the things that we did.
And Dr. King met with your group following this sit-in. What did he have to say to you?
Well, he always he was very charismatic with their people. He had a way that he could deal with people. And he constantly told us that, hey, listen, the danger that it was because of the fact that it was just the bus boycott, Montgomery County bus boycott, had happened in 1955, which he was very instrumental in dealing with. So he constantly told us, hey, listen, there are those of you who may not feel that you can do this. So we're not going to look down on you if you don't go. But, you know, this is something that we feel that we should do. And that's what we did.
How did getting expelled from college end up impacting your life?
Oh, that was a great impact, because when I was first expelled, I got a scholarship through the organization of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. And I chose, we had different cities that we could choose in order to go. And I chose California because I had relatives in the area that I decided to go. And I went to San Jose State, and that was in San Jose, California. I was in my, when I first got there, they refused to let me in because they were saying that we don't want rabble-rousers and so forth in the school. But because of people that were behind us, I didn't get in the first semester, but I was able to get in the second semester. I left in my senior year. I had 18 more units to complete, but unfortunately, fortunately, as they say, I was married because I had a kid on the way, and we are still together after 57 years.
All right. Well, we have to wrap it there, but St. John Dixon, thank you so much. St. John Dixon protested against segregation at the Montgomery County Courthouse 60 years ago today. St. John, thanks again.
You're welcome. Bye.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.